Oil Gas. It's 8:37 on Monday morning, April 2nd, 2007. My name is Vic Coring. I chair the committee, and with us we have representatives of Mike Dugan, Scott Kawasaki, Jay Ramirez, Ralph Samuels, Vice Chair Kurt Olson, and Nancy Dahlstrom. We welcome you to the meeting here of House Bill 177, the AGIA bill. We're hoping to be able to move this bill out of committee today. If all goes well, we've got amendments before us. And I think what we're going to do is take those amendments in blocks based on the individual member of the committee here. I think it'll be a little less confusing that way as opposed to going back and forth. We'll just take them legislator at a time. Hopefully get through these today. We have a House floor session at 11 o'clock this morning, and my goal is to have this thing done before then. If we can't, we'll just have to meet again. The Resources Committee that has this bill following us has scheduled this a bill for next week, so we aren't under enormous pressure to necessarily move it today, but that certainly is my goal, and that's what I've been stating all along, so let's shoot for that as a goal here. Did you have a thought, Representative Ramos?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The administration was supposed to draft an amendment for me. They have not drafted it yet. This is their bill. I've worked closely with them. I would be very happy if we stretched it in tomorrow on proposing amendments, because it's a very important amendment to my community, which has to do with gasifying mm-hmm. communities that don't have natural gas infrastructure. So unless you're going to allow for some conceptual amendments, I just would feel very strongly that when one day, I don't know that we can satisfy that. I was just with the Commissioner of Revenue and asked where that amendment was that they had were going to draft for me.
Well, I certainly would be happy to entertain a conceptual amendment if you feel that would be adequate as far as getting the wording correct, but if not, we can always meet an additional day, because my goal here, of course, is not just simply to expedite things, but it's to make sure we expedite in a good way and that we produce a good piece of legislation here that we're all comfortable with. That's what we've been intending all along. So if it takes an extra day, that's fine with me. As you probably recall, on Friday there was a motion to adopt the committee substitute that we had before us at that time, and there was an objection, and the bill actually remained in a state of limbo. So we still have that before us, and I'd like to ask if Representative Dugan wishes to remove that objection.
I do, Mr. Chairman. That.
Okay. Is there any discussion on the committee substitute before we actually adopt that, or any further objection to the committee substitute? Seeing no further objection, the CS has been adopted. So we have that as the working draft before us, from which we can amend it as we move along here.
Wow.
Okay. I guess what we'll do is get into the amendments at this point. And Representative Dugan, I'd like to begin with you if you'd like to start this process here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Somebody has to tell me how to do this. Do I move the amendment?
Yes. Number one.
And we will call it your first amendment number one here, and we'll just...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number one.
Object.
Okay. There is objection number one. Representative Dugan, would you please speak to your amendment?
Yes,
please.
Mr. Chairman. This amendment number one, which is, I believe, should be in your packet as Bullock E9, is a series of corrections to what I'm thinking of as 5 a.m. drafting errors. Since we didn't do a subsequent CS, we have to do something to correct these, and this is a list as comprehensive as I could make it of what I had found.
Okay. Does anybody care to speak to amendment number one? Do you wish to remove your objection?
Yes, I do.
Samuels? Okay. With hearing no further objection, amendment number one is adopted as read. Representative Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number two.
Objection for the purpose of discussion,
yes.
I assume? Okay, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The current language of, we're at 13, line 18, so I better know what I'm talking about here, but This is to make sure that when there are reimbursements made, either under the contract or under the terms of abandonment, that they are the qualified costs of the licensee and not all costs. And it's simply to clarify. The bill makes a distinction between the licensee's costs and the license, the costs that are qualified under the bill for reimbursement or however the payment's going to be made. Mm-hmm. This simply carries that forward throughout the bill to make sure that we're only dealing with qualified costs.
Any further discussion on amendment number two? Representative Samuels?
I move my objection to amendment number two.
Seeing, hearing no further objection, amendment number two, it has been adopted. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number three.
Object.
Object for discussion. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What this does is add to the section at page 15, line 7. It talks about the commissioners being able to suspend disbursement to the licensee with a written notice that there's some violation that has occurred. And what this does is it adds a sentence that says that the commissioners may resume disbursement if, in their view, the violation has been cured. Mm-hmm. That's not explicit in here. The rest of the language talks about how they'll get that settled if they don't have an agreement. This simply lets the commissioners say, you've got a problem, let's the licensee fix it, and lets the commissioners resume the disbursements.
Okay. Representative Samuels?
Thank you, and I will remove my objection in just a moment, but in the next committee, I think that we should probably take a look at this. What if it were a three-year delay, the costs that are there incurred by the licensee, if there's been a violation, do we keep disbursing the money? What happens if it's not just a month-long misunderstanding and you fix it? But the commissioners may resume. You could be into an administration. You could be into two administrations from now. You could be two governors from now. And when you start to resume, and I understand the point, and I'll remove my objection, but I think that it is something that the next committee should probably start to look at. On what happens if there is a very long time period there. And with that, I'll remove my objection to amendment number three.
Thank you, Representative Samuels. With that objection being removed, amendment number three has been adopted. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number four.
Check.
Objected for the purpose of discussion. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Amendment number four says, the language currently says, let me see if I can find this. Says that this is the provision on being able to freeze taxes, and it says that the freeze will be the taxes that are in effect at the conclusion of the open season. Mm-hmm. Practically speaking, people who are thinking about committing gas are going to want to know what the tax rate's going to be at the beginning of the open season, and not just hoping for what it's going to be at the end of the open season. And so this amendment changes that to say, as it now says, at the conclusion of the first binding open season. With this amendment, it would say at the start of the first binding open season.
Mm-hmm. Move my objection to amendment number four.
Okay. Further objection? Seeing none, amendment number four has been passed. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number five.
Object.
Objected for discussion. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Currently, the law says that the state gets a representative on all, and I forget exactly what the phrasing is, but it gets to sit in on all of the meetings mm-hmm. By the licensee and the contractors and all the rest of that. Mm-hmm. But that authority terminates with the start of operations of the pipeline under this version, the current version of the bill. This amendment would essentially keep a state representative on the governing board mm-hmm. Throughout the operation of the pipeline.
Okay. And by the way, that's an improvement to what we had talked about at the last meeting. I want to thank you for catching that and suggesting that improvement. I think that's very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, could we ask Mr. Bullock to come up and address that?
We can do that.
Mr. Chair, Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Don Bullock. I just want to correct that the amendment should refer to page 14, line 11, not 10.
Thank you, Mr. Bullock. I'll be noted for the record that this amendment is on line 11, page 14, as opposed to line 10.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, yes, Commissioner.
I see him, yes. Mr. Galvin, Commissioner of Revenue. And by the way, previously that was Don Bullock, legislative counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Galvin, Commissioner of Revenue. We're looking at this for the first time, and I guess my only concern first blush is how we would define or consider what it means by conclusion of operations permitted by the license. Is that the entire length of time of operations of the pipeline?
That's what the I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, no problem.
Commissioner Dugan. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, that is what the language contemplates.
Maybe a slight wording change, changing the word permitted, since it's not really what's permitted under, but conclusion of the operations of the project. Something to the project related to the license or some variation on that. I don't know if Don has any suggestions, but making it so that it's the actual operations of the project as opposed to the operations permitted under license, because that might be a little confusing.
I don't have any problems with any amendment that will make this clearer, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Bullock, did you care to add?
Again, this is Don Bullock, Legislative Counsel. I think this raises the issue of what's the duration of the license itself. Does the license continue after the commencement of commercial operations? And okay, the commissioner says it does. So that does.
Our intent in establishing the term of the license is that in order to be able to enforce the expansion provisions and some of the other provisions that deal with the operations of the pipeline, that the term of the license does continue past the commencement of commercial operations. And so I don't have a problem referencing that, and if the legislature feels that we need to have the ability to have people present at these meetings, you know, we don't object to that. I think we just need to clear the language so that it makes a clear reference to operations of the operations of the project.
Yes.
What's the right adjective? Referenced by the license or included?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps conceptually it should just be so long as the terms of the license continue to apply.
Okay.
Can you say that again, Don? So long as the terms of the...
Of the terms of the license continue to apply. In other words, that means that the state continues to have an interest as long as the terms of the license are applying. So this would make the two periods of interest coincide.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are those the same, Commissioner?
Yes.
Okay.
After the license has been issued, and so long as the terms of the license continue to apply, the licensee shall allow the commissioners to.
Yes.
Okay.
So that, Mr. Chairman, so that the amendment would read, subject to some minor editing, after a license has been issued and before, the new language, and so long as the terms of the license continue to apply, comma, and then back to the original language, the licensee shall allow the commissioners to.
I think the before probably has to drop. So it would be and.
Okay, we have the amended version of the amendment for us. Are you amenable to that change?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I would move the amendment to the amendment.
Yeah, we have a motion to move. We have a motion to amend the amendment.
As for stated by the counselor.
See no objection to the motion to amend the amendment. We have the full amendment before us.
And I will move my objection to amendment number 5, Mr. Chairman.
And that objection to the full amendment number 5 has been objected. Seeing no further objection, amendment number 5, as amended, has been adopted. So Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number 6.
Object.
Has been objected to.
No problem. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bill currently provides for two situations, one in which an entity that has the licensee that has the financing has a year to go forward, and if the licensee fails to go forward in that year, everything that was produced basically under the terms of the license becomes the state's property at no cost to the state. The second situation is when someone, a licensee, does not have the financing, and it allows 5 years for them to proceed, and if they don't, the current law provides that the state has to pay the licensee's cost to get whatever has been produced under the license. This amendment would change that second provision to be the same as the first, so that in either case, if the licensee failed to go forward, the material that was produced under the terms of the license would become the state's at no cost.
Representative Samuels?
Move my objection to amendment number 6.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Representative Dugan.
I believe the commissioner would like to be heard on this. Is that okay?
Sure, you bet. Commissioner Galvin.
Yes, thank you. When we were putting together the basic structure, and Representative Dugan described our intent, what we're trying to do is balance the state's interest in basically acquiring the property that we have invested in with a commercially responsive sharing of the risk that a project may get to this point and not get the commitment and end up ultimately not having that come through before the end of the 5 years. And in our weighing of that risk, we were concerned that if in the end of that period of time the state would just get all the product without any reimbursement, that it may be seen as something that's too unattractive for them to initially participate in the first place. Our ultimate goal here is to get competition. We need to get applications in, and this is something that we considered to be potentially a barrier for somebody to ultimately take the plunge and join us in this venture. And so just advise you, we don't have any direct information from anybody saying if you put this in, no way are we coming, but it's just something that we're concerned about pushing the envelope too far.
Okay. Thank you. Any further thoughts in regard to amendment number 6 in light of the discussion we've heard?
If we have just a minute. Mr. Chairman,
brief ideas. Is that what you're
I don't need a brief at ease. I just I feel like we're moving too swiftly for my comfort. I need to.
Okay. All right. Do you care to speak to the amendment for us during this minute?
No, sir.
Okay. Well, how about if we just take a brief at ease for 1 minute then to give you a chance to look it over and collect your thoughts?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So we're at ease for a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This citation should actually read line 14 instead of line 20.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these were drafted to the older version of the bill, and I'm informed that if I move conceptual amendments, it will cure that problem, and I'll try to remember to do that from now on. Thank you.
Well, let's note these then as the conceptual amendments as we move along in the event that we have the order of the numbers are incorrect, so we don't have any problems here down the road. Okay. Is there any further comment on amendment number 6, or is there any further objections to this? Okay. Hearing none, amendment number 6 has been adopted. So we'll move to amendment number 7. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number 7.
Object.
Has been objected, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Where does this go?
Sorry. The first one is on page 13, line 27. The second is on page 23, line 7. The bill sets out a series of assessment criteria, which are essentially boiled down to net present value calculation and a likelihood to succeed. This amendment would make it clear that when modification or amendment or assignment occurs, that the value that is being, that the value that is being affected and must be assessed is the same as the one under which the license was awarded. That is to say, the net present value calculation, and not some, any broader definition of value that, that might enter into the discussion.
Do you care to speak to your objection, Ribbon and Ramirez?
No, I would remove my objection.
Okay. Any further objection to this amendment, number 7?
Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner Galvin wishes to speak to amendment number 7. Go ahead, sir.
I'll maintain my objection.
Okay. Sorry. We do recognize that this does have a substantive change to some regard. We recognized in the original language was the fact that although it doesn't directly mirror the evaluation criteria that does appropriately say net present value and likelihood of success are the primary drivers, when we get to the point where we're looking at amendments or potentially assignments and the commissioners are making the determination on whether or not to go with that, we felt more comfortable with evaluation of all the values to the state that may be affected by the project as opposed to simply the economic. This does limit you to simply economic valuation as a part of that evaluation. So it is a substantive change. We don't we don't strongly object, but we just want to note that it is a change. We would prefer to have the broader discretion. Mm-hmm. But again, that's up to you guys.
I'll maintain my objection there.
Okay. Any further discussion on the motion before us? The amendment has been objected to, and that objection has not been removed. So at this point, unless there's further discussion, I'd like to call for a roll call vote from the members. Madam Clerk?
Representative Sandman?
Yes.
Representative Ramos?
No.
Representative Dugan?
Yes.
Representative Kawasaki?
No.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom?
No.
Chair Coring?
Yes. So with a vote of 4-3, the amendment number 7 has been adopted. We'll move on to amendment number 8. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number 8.
Any objection to amendment number 8?
Object.
We have an objection for discussion, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is simply an attempt that I've discussed with the drafter to clarify that the 15% rolled in rate is the original 15%. That is, you can go up to 115%. You can't go up to 15% of the 115% and so on. Mm-hmm. So that all this is an attempt to try and make that a little bit clearer.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Galvin?
We don't object to making this change because it does clarify the language so that it does reflect our intent, but just wanted to note that we are working on a more comprehensive rewrite of the rolled-in rate section simply because we've realized that there are some areas that need to be further clarified, the treatment of some of the rates. And so just note that in the next committee, we will likely be providing additional clarification in this regard, all to be remain consistent with our original intent, which is the one that we've stated here.
I'll remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
Objection has been removed by Representative Samuels. Any further discussion or further objection to this amendment? Seeing none, amendment number 8 has been adopted. Amendment number 9, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe I'd like to pass over amendment number 9. I think this is merely conforming language for another amendment on this, the topic of the coordinator, which I believe is going to come before us.
Okay.
So if we could just delay this until that happens, we'll know whether we need this one.
Okay. So we'll put number 9 aside for now and address that later if we need to. Okay. We'll move on to amendment number 10. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move. It's a real amendment number 10.
We have an objection to the amendment. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an attempt to spell out more fully what happens. There's a series of sections about abandonment, which prescribes how abandonment will be handled in the case of an arbiter's decision and in the case of and in other cases as well. And this is an attempt to say that if you get an arbiter's decision that if the licensee wants to abandon and the state doesn't, and the arbiter agrees with the state, then we can assume we are then in a situation where the state has an unwilling partner, and this language attempts to give the state, or it gives the state a way to terminate an agreement with an unwilling partner, even if the arbiter has ruled in the state's favor.
Do you wish to speak to that, Mr. Gallagher?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. There's actually two parts to this. The first part, the first two amendments are actually going to the violations section, that is the
is this the upgrade code?
Section 230, and adds clarifying language that if the license is revoked,
right,
that they have to assign all the data. And that seems to us a bit duplicative, because if you look at the previous subsection E, among the list of possible remedies is 3 license revocation and 4 assignment of all the data. And so adding in if the license is revoked, then they'll assign all the data seems a bit to us duplicative of the previous section, because since that's one of the alternate remedies as well. You can speak to that one before we move into the next.
Excuse me. Mr. Chairman, let me just talk a little bit about this amendment first from the drafting standpoint. It involves a structural change, and then it applies to a situation where the option that the commissioners have exercised above is to actually revoke the license. And so it makes the existing requirement on page 15 may not submit, so the licensee, first of all, may not submit an application for the license in the event. We use may, but may not means you can't. Then it adds a new one. In addition to prohibiting them from applying again, this adds us a question that if it's revoked, for sure it's revoked, then they are required to deliver the information that's in the amendment. It could be, if the administration would want to do something like that, they could amend, suggest that you amend the subsection E, license revocation and assignment to the state, and that would accomplish the same thing. But Mr. Dugan's amendment does do what he wants. If it's revoked, then it's clear that those interests and those property, that property would be transferred. Mm-hmm. So there's another way to do it, but mm-hmm. this amendment would do what he wants.
Right, and for the record, that was Don Bullock. Mr. Galvin?
And I guess just to frame that issue, from our perspective, it's a question of whether the legislature wants to mandate that if the commissioners determine that the license needs to be revoked, that all the data has to be turned over, or whether it's a situation where the commissioners can determine to revoke and to require the turning over the data, or possibly just to revoke and not require it to be turned over. So it's just a matter of whether those two have to go hand in hand or not. And the amendment would accomplish the linkage that revocation mandates turning the information over.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, can you give me an example of why we would not want the information?
It's not necessarily a question of whether we would want it or not. It would probably be more a question of whether the reason why we would find the project to be in violation was something that we felt was appropriate for them to take the information, if we're at the particular point in time where they've expended money that we feel they need to turn their data over. In other words, we've got 50% of the cost that we're sharing up to open season, potentially. We're in here, we're making it up to 50%. And the question is, if at some point along the lines there's some violation and the determination is made to revoke the license, are we at a point in time where we feel it's appropriate for us to take possession of 100% of the work product, including the stuff that, that they spent money on? And from, I think, again, goes back to the commercially reasonable terms, wanting to make something that is offer that the companies that were trying to participate in this project will feel that they're not subjecting themselves to too much risk. I think the concern here is that we have a fairly broad discretion with regard to finding them in violation of a portion of this, and I think a applicant would feel that they are subjecting themselves to potentially spending tens of millions of dollars, having the state try to call them on some technical violation of the contract and then try to yank all the work product out of them. And I think that would cause concern for people who are thinking about entering into this venture with the state. Again, we're dealing in a environment where there are parties that we're trying to bring into this process who have felt that the state has used them in the past, and the state is trying through the terms of this AGIA bill to get them back into the fold and to trust the state that they can engage and contract with us and that their interests will be protected. And I think to mandate that if the commissioners find a violation that all the data would have to be turned over is one of those terms that will cause a party to have some pause about entering into this relationship.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you. I think I agree with amendment number 10. If we're trying to get rid of them, and we actually, therefore, our gas pipeline project has died, so to speak, or we've gone a different route, we're going to have to then pay again for that information. Any engineering data or permitting or whatever the data is, we're going to have, if we don't get it from these guys, which we've now paid our percentage and we're paid three times to get rid of them, three times the costs, if we don't get everything from them, then we just have to go out and we spend more money getting it from somebody else, and the work's already been done.
Representative Samuels, through the chair. At this moment, I'm only talking about, if you look at the amendment, up down to line 9 of the amendment, we're only dealing with the section dealing with license violations. I haven't begun to speak to the section dealing with abandonment. And so my concern is only in that section where the right now, I mean, I wouldn't say, to be clear, I have concerns about the remainder that I haven't spoken to yet, but my statements thus far have been directed towards the situation where the commissioners are exercising their authority to find the licensee in violation and finding that they haven't cured it and then finding how to remedy that and then whether that's going to result in them turning over their data. It's just a matter of how much we want to put our thumb on that side of the scale right now. The way it's written, the commissioners have the authority to request that, but to make it so that if the license is revoked, the party has to give us all the data seems potentially to cause a message going across that at any point in time we could end up just yanking all the data from them. It would cause me concern if I were on the side of trying to evaluate whether to enter into this.
Representative Samuels?
Thank you. So explain to me then, without it, they'll just tell you no. You can request all you want to, and they're just not going to turn anything over to you then.
Without the change.
I realize you got to pick one way or another, but if you don't have it, then you can ask, and they're going to say, gee, thanks, I'll sell it to you.
Without the change, the way that the language currently is written in the bill, the commissioners may impose one or more of the following remedies, and one of those that the commissioners may impose is assignment to the state of all project data that were required. That can still be imposed by the commissioners. The only distinction is whether it's mandated that if the commissioners revoke the license, that the licensee is then automatically obligated to turn over. The commissioners don't have the discretion whether to ask or not. The change under this amendment would mandate that the commissioners have to get the data if they decide to revoke the license. It's just tying those two together, where under the current language they're not tied together, but the authority still exists for the commissioners to demand the data. And I'm still would like to speak to the remainder of the.
Okay. Well, I'd like to go to Representative Dawson. She's been waiting to ask a question here for quite some time.
So, Representative Dawson. The maker of the amendment, Mr. Representative Dugan, would you consider a friendly amendment to divide
Absolutely.
Amendment 10 into. So we would have conceptually line 1 through 9 would
Mr.
be
Chairman,
amendment number 10.
On that point?
On that point, Representative Samuels?
Thank you. Before we did that, I'd like to hear the commissioner's comment on the second part of it, because
sure.
If they're both no, then.
Yes.
Save some time.
And, Mr. Chairman, also, I know, I believe that online we may have some folks from the Department of Natural Resources, Oil and Gas Commercial Section who may mm-hmm. Be able to shed some additional light on what they see as the potential impact from the point of view of the potential participants in this, of making the changes to these commercial arrangements.
Is that Mr. Scott that you're referring to?
Yeah, I think, is he online?
My understanding that he is online. Can we confirm that with the clerk? Is Mr. Scott online right now?
I am. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Anthony Scott. I work for the Division of Oil and Gas. I don't have the amendment in front of me, so I'm speaking on the basis of what I've been able to gather from the conversation over the phone. That said, if in general, if it's the case that the project is deemed to be uneconomic, then the thought is that it's not economic, and it's not therefore commercially reasonable to require someone to disgorge the product that they have in good faith developed to date. So just in terms of a commercially reasonable mm-hmm. partnership in general, it doesn't strike us as commercially normal to require that disgorging.
And for the record, that was Anthony Scott with the Division of Oil and Gas. Representative Dugan.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not exactly sure what to do here. I don't really want to try and write a bill here that the administration doesn't want to go out and enforce, but commercially normal doesn't describe a relationship in which one of the partners is paying 50% of the cost and essentially doesn't have any rights to the work product. What this attempts to do, in light of the fact that the state proposes to pay up to 50% of the cost of the original, of creating the original product, and up to 80% of the cost following a failed open season for creating the rest of the work product, to give the state a right to that work product. That's simply all it does. Otherwise, essentially, we're paying 50% of whatever it is and 80% of whatever it is, and at the close of the day, if the thing doesn't work out, we end up empty-handed, as near as I can tell, or we could end up empty-handed, as near as I can tell from the current draft.
Mr. Galvin.
Mr. Chair, there are a number of places in the bill where there is the opportunity to acquire the data. In some of the cases, it says that the state will acquire the data at no additional cost. In other places, it says we'll acquire it at the licensee's net cost. The intent there, when you see the distinction, is when the situations arise where basically the state has that there's some action that the licensee has taken that has put the state in this position, then the transfer of all the data with no additional compensation is seen as an accomplishment of fulfilling some aspect of I don't want to say punitive because punitive is not contractual, but basically the state is getting everything at no additional cost because the licensee has taken some action that has set up that situation. In situations in the bill where the events are outside of the licensee's control that have led to the state wanting to terminate the relationship, then we felt it was appropriate for the state not to have to pay the amount again. But as Representative Dugan said, at this point, the state has paid some portion and the licensee has paid some portion. And so if we're at that point where the state wants to get this data, the licensee hasn't done anything to require them to have to give up everything at no cost, then the state has to pay the licensee's portion to then get the rest of the documents, as opposed to the licensee having to give the state a form of a windfall in that we get all of the data with only having to pay a portion of the cost to acquire it. And so we are trying to balance these things as we go through and split that part out. But at no point does the state have to pay for it twice. And I think that we're more than happy to talk about when one scenario should arise versus another. But our primary concern is if it's seen that the state can take action where the licensee has not done anything to engender the situation and make the state reach this conclusion, the state can reach out and grab the entire value of the work product after having only expended a portion of the cost to get there, that's going to be seen as something that parties are not going to want to enter into that kind of relationship.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dugan, followed by Rivers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, are you back on the first part of the amendment? Because the second part of the amendment says pretty clearly the state shall pay the licensee the actual amount of qualified expenditures incurred through the date the license is terminated. This language is simply intended to encompass all the possible scenarios you get when you are trying to figure out what's uneconomic. They may agree. The commissioners may think it's uneconomic and the licensee may think otherwise. The commissioners may think it's economic and the licensee may think otherwise. And that's...
Mr. Representative Dugan, through the chair, just there's two sections, two scenarios, as you point out.
Right.
The first scenario of the second, now we're moving from, just so we're clear, we're moving from the violation revocation portion now into the abandonment portion.
Correct.
Where we're now into the uneconomic determination. The first part under this subsection E is a situation where the state wants to find it uneconomic and the licensee disagrees, thinks it's still economic and wants to proceed with it. We go to the arbitration panel and the state loses. The arbitration panel says it is economic. There's no reason to get out. And under the amendment terms, the state would be obligated to pay three times the damages. We don't feel that that would be appropriate, frankly, because that establishes a demand price on the licensee's part, where if we would prefer that under the terms of the arrangement, clearly the worst case scenario is the state has to pay three times the cost. That's intended to be when we were to take action to advantage another project. And rather than creating an imaginary project and creating an advantage for it simply to trigger that so that we can get out of the contract, we clearly can tell the licensee, look, we want out of this, and work out something to where we can get out, with three times being the worst case. That's the high price. And it's just a matter of what's it going to be to get out of the arrangement. By making this language in here, we clearly state that we're obligated to pay them three times. And that, to me, creates it puts the state in a worse situation than if it were silent on that issue. The second part, under E2, is the scenario where it's the licensee who wants to get out of the deal, and they say it's uneconomic, and we say, no, it is economic. And they go to the arbitration panel, and the arbitration panel agrees with us and says it is economic. In that scenario, then, we're still in the same situation where they want to get out and we don't want them to. They're obligated to do certain things still under the lease, and if they don't, then we go back to that violation section. Then they will ultimately be in violation of, and that then triggers all those remedies that are available to the commissioners for them to be in violation. And it's actually a broader scope of remedies than what is being provided here. And so we believe that the current language of the bill actually protects the state's interest to a greater extent than providing this language here, because it binds the state's remedies in either situation.
We'll go to Representative Ramos, Dugan, and then Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm mindful of the fact that the way that this bill is drafted, that to some extent it's an RFP. We want to get a concept and then take the concept and go through many, many parts of it. So I believe I grasp what the Representative Dugan is doing in drafting 10A and 10B, but I appreciate the explicitness of 10B, but ultimately it seems like we're interested in trying to attract a licensee. And what I think I'm hearing from the administration, and if you could be explicit with me, Commissioner, I'd be grateful. What I think I'm hearing from the administration is that this, although it may help once we have a licensee to hold them accountable to a greater standard, which is Representative Dugan's intent, what I think I hear from the Commissioner of Revenue is that the rigidness, and I have some concerns about the rigidity inside of the AGEA bill, that if we make it too rigid, we may fail in attracting the breadth of licensees that we want in order to be able to select the best of breed. And so if I understand that correctly, then I believe I'm going to vote against this amendment in order to better attract a better class of potential licensees, and then rely on the project working because we have the best licensee, rather than on trying to retain the most amount of material from a project that was later found to be non-economic. So I believe I understand both positions correctly, that Representative Dugan is looking out for us. Once we have a project that then is found non-economic, we can better keep the information, but that the administration is trying to keep something that's broader to catch more, something with honey to catch more flies, and that this chokes down the amount of honey that's sitting on the windowsill. So with that, I believe, Mr. Chairman, that I'm going to did I object, or did I think I'm going to maintain my objection or vote against Amendment Number 10 when I have the opportunity? The clarification that I would ask from the Commissioner is whether that's a correct reading of both 10A and 10B, given that lines 1 through 8 would be 10A and lines the remainder of the bill, line 10, would be 10B, whether I'm reading that correctly on both parts, and I believe that I am.
To that point briefly, Mr. Bullock, please.
I just want to talk a little bit, put this into context. There's a couple of things that are happening here. The Gasline Inducement Act is to induce somebody to build a project. Mm-hmm. And there's certain incentives that the state's giving. So there's two economic interests in the project. There's the inducements and the state interest that's expressed through the license, and you have a gas pipeline project that's going on. If uneconomic is determined both from the state's interest separately or in addition to the pipeline project's interest, it may be uneconomic from the standpoint of the state, and the state will say, we're not going to contribute anymore. But to the developer of the project, it may still be a good project if it no longer has to comply with the conditions of the license. So you could conceivably have the option that a gas line continues, the license is abandoned, and those terms that are in the license drop away as the result of abandonment. And so when you're considering this issue of buying the information the state's already paid for, it may still have some value to an ongoing project. The way the amendment is drafted, it says the commissioner, if they disagree, they may terminate the license and then compensate. And you can put more flexibility in response to the suggestion of the commissioner that they can negotiate for the cost of those with a cap that whatever payment they negotiate can't exceed three times. So, I mean, as long as it just, you know, if you want to not imperil the ongoing gas line, even if it doesn't have the conditions and the license, then there's still the decision whether you want that information, whether you want to pay it, or whether it continues to be a good investment. And right now, the commissioners could make that decision whether to buy it or not.
Representative Dugan and Samuels?
I yield to Representative Samuels, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Samuels?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that we divide the question. I agree with the commissioner on half and disagree with the commissioner on half. So I would move that Amendment 10A be lines 1 through 9, and then as a separate issue, 10B, lines 10 through the remainder of the amendment.
Okay, we have a motion to divide the question as stated by representatives. Okay, brief it is, please.
Oh, did you actually make the motion?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Then I will remove my objection to dividing.
To get back to amendment number 16, Representative Samuels, do you have any further comments on your amendment?
No, Representative, or Commissioner Galvin, he's familiar with the amendment, I know. He debated it at length in the other body yesterday, so.
Yeah.
Okay, I'd like to remove my objection to this amendment. Is there any further objection or comment to amendment number 16? Wait just for a moment. Mr. Galvin, do you care to
just speak to so that the record's clear, we had a long discussion about this yesterday in the Senate side. And I just for the benefit of this committee, I would ask if we can maybe have Dr. Anthony Scott again talk to the actual the discount rate percentages. Anthony doesn't see this, but what it's similar language to what.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anthony Scott. I work for the Division of Oil and Gas.
And Anthony, just
yes.
Where are you going? What we have is language similar to what you saw yesterday in the Senate Resources version. Use an undiscounted value and at a minimum discount rates of 2, 6, and 8%. And if you can just talk to that, the bracket, and whether those are in your view, the appropriate increments within that bracket?
Sure, Commissioner. The high end of the bracket of 8%, I think, is well-reasoned. It comports with, roughly speaking, the long-term rate of return earned by the permanent fund, if you take a long enough period of time. So it represents, arguably, the upper end of the state's opportunity cost. 2% is a reasonable stand-in for a relatively low inflation rate, and so you're keeping the discount rate. You're using essentially today's dollars with no measure of impatience. I would like to speak to the 0 and 6%. Undiscounted cash is not a relevant measure of economic value. And so a zero discount rate really makes very little sense for doing any economic analysis. 6%, I don't really know what the rationale for that is, but I would suggest maybe replacing it with 5%. We, the state, have had a study done for us by an economist who is now on the President's Council of Economic Advisors, and his recommendation was that 5% was an appropriate discount rate to use in a number of circumstances for the state. And that concludes my input.
Chairman?
Representative Samuels?
Thank you. I would amend 6 to 5. I just wanted to have a suite on there, and I would still maintain that having more information is better. So I would still keep the undiscounted value in there. And an amendment to the amendment of switching 6 to 5.
Any objection to making that amendment as noted? Seeing none, Representative Elstrom?
And I came in late, so I apologize. The 8% is still in, or was that
yes.
the reading?
Yeah.
That is still in?
2, 5, and 8. Yeah.
2, 5, and 8. Oh, right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There's no objection to amending the amendment. That has been adopted. We're back to the full amendment. Any further discussion on amendment number 16 as amended? I'd like to remove my objection that I indicated initially. With no further objection, that amendment has been adopted. Amendment number 17, Representative Samuels.
Thank you. I move amendment number 17, which is to page 7, line 22. It is to do with more design on the gas treatment plant.
I'll object just for discussion. Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What we attempted to do in this amendment was to have more information on the GTP, which will be a federally regulated entity, and I want more. If the midstream entity is going to bid for the license on this, they should have more of a complete design done. But you should describe who's going to own it. You should describe more than the original bill had in there, because it's going to be a large part of the process. I'll just leave it at that. With that, I'm move amendment number 17.
Okay. For further discussion, I'll remove my objection. Any further objection to amendment number 17? Hearing none, 17 is passed. We'll now move to amendment number 18, Representative Samuels.
Number 18 is page 11, line 4. On to the CS, and it goes to the application evaluation. Did I move the amendment?
Yes, you did, and I objected.
No, I don't have amendment number.
It's a three that are stapled together.
Okay. Let's just take a brief out of here.
Oh, I'm good, Mr. Chairman.
That part of the criteria is that, and you can read there, the reasonable specificity and feasibility of the applicant's work plan, timeline, and budget required be submitted under the site, including the applicant's plan to manage cost overruns and the degree which the applicant intends to insulate shippers from the effects of cost overruns and encourage shippers to participate in the first binding open season. So how are you going to talk people into giving you the gas? You should be able to, on the application process, articulate that. That's amendment number 18.
I'll remove my objection. Any further objection? Seeing none, amendment number 18 is passed. Move to amendment number 19. Representative Samuels.
I move amendment number 19.
Object for discussion.
And what this does is on the rolled-in tariff portion of it, I tried to find some middle ground here. One of the pieces of testimony from the administration was that if the midstream entity must testify to get the inducements to the 15% on the rolled-in rates, and the shippers, in order to get the tax lock-in, have to testify. Everybody's going to testify. If you want something from the bill, you have to go before FERC and testify the same way. The FERC can override all that if they still choose to, but you have to testify the same. And tried to find some middle ground. One of the pieces of testimony from the administration was that the regulation could change. The FERC right now has a rebuttable presumption of rolled-in tariffs, and that regulation could change. So what I said here was that as long as the rebuttable presumption is at FERC, as long as that, you've got the rebuttable presumption, you will have the midstream entity, which must defend the rolled-in tariff, and then the shippers can argue their own interests, and you will have some on one side and you will have some on the other side, potentially. They could all be lined up one way or another. Well, actually, they would never all be rolled up. if it went down, they would. But the shippers could then argue their own interests. The state could choose to argue how it so chose. And with the FERC, you're still having the leaning that I think that we all want, but you're still having the FERC being able to hear both sides of a story. And I'm reticent to not adopt this and lock the state into a policy, which we don't know if we're going to like at the end of the day. When the people signed up for the we will defend the, I believe the TSM, and they're very well-intentioned state officials that agreed to do something, and we ended up defending positions which we disagreed with at the end of the day. So us locking ourselves into a thing because this administration likes it, and something that could be three governors from now, I think it is probably better to allow the FERC to hear, as long as they've got the rebuttable presumption in there. We won that in court. Thank you, Mr. Shepler. We Mr. Shepler did a very good job. We won in Congress, we won in court, but now I still think that we should allow FERC to at least hear there might be competing views. The state can testify, the midstream entity must testify, and the FERC already has its rebuttable presumption, so I think it is a good middle ground on Amendment Number 19.
Mr. Chairman, just
Representative Ramos,
is this page 15, line 14?
Yes, it is.
Mr. Bullock, was this off the original bill?
15 line 14.
I would defer to Mr. Bullock, the drafter of this. It does not say the E version, so.
Yeah, it's off the B.
Let's go back to page 8.
This is Don Bullock. The changes would actually be on page 20, and I think it would go into on line 5, where it talks about the agreement not to protest in that part of the bill.
Oh, right.
That's relating to the royalty and the tax condition is in the next page on page 21.
Okay, my apologies to the committee. I should have caught that and had it redrafted.
Yeah, right there.
See, okay, so.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, question?
Representative Nelson?
So line 1 is actually page 20, line 15, and then on line 5, it's page 21, line what?
6.
Like, okay.
Yeah, at the end of line 6.
Okay.
I mean, it's offered conceptually to modify the conditions under which the person that receives the royalty and the tax inducement can or cannot protest or participate in the FERC proceeding.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Samuels.
Conceptually, I want to make sure that we're all clear on this. This does not apply to the midstream entity. The midstream entity still must defend the position that the state wants to defend in the legislation. This only applies to the shipper as long as FERC has the rebuttable presumption. That's the intent of the Amendment Number 19, Conceptual Amendment Number 19.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Galvin?
If you'd like us to speak to this. We have significant objection to this amendment. We are, as you heard from our testimony, we're very committed to having rolled-in rates apply to the expansion provisions. And just kind of responding in order, and then I'd like to also ask Anthony Scott to respond as well. But just from a a direct response to some of the statements that were made by Representative Samuels. If the point in time comes where we find ourselves where the state would like to oppose the use of rolled-in rates, number one, the state in here is not bound to speak in favor of that at that particular time. We're just making an obligation on the part of the folks who make their initial shipping commitment that they would have to. But the other part is to understand is that we could allow them, if we decide that it's in the state's interest to waive that provision, we could allow them to go and testify if we find that the use of rolled-in rates would be detrimental to the state. So that's that to me, that's a non-issue. I think the true issue here is whether we're going to potentially preclude a party from committing their gas to that initial term because we're obligating them to make this commitment not to oppose rolled-in rates. And I think that's a legitimate question to talk about because we are trying to, again, on both the midstream and the upstream, make a package of inducements that attract folks and not create artificial barriers that are going to ultimately preclude them from doing the action that we want them to take, which in this case is commit their gas. And so we believe that in the balance of those, that requiring the party to commit not to oppose rolled-in rates weighs more in favor of having the state keep those rolled-in rates as guaranteed as we can, because in the end, it's not just about ultimately succeeding in getting the rates. It's that we want to have the explorers have confidence that the expansion will take place in a reasonable time and the tariff will be established in a fairly expedited manner. And if an explorer has to look forward to a drawn-out process at FERC to determine whether or not the rebuttable presumption should work, and we've got appeals coming in from the folks who are getting our inducements, it seems counter to our ultimate goal of having explorers feel that they can go out and drill that well with the expectation that they're going to get these expansion if they have a successful exploration well. And that, in our view, the balance tips towards wanting to have this be a requirement to get that upstream inducement. As far as sort of the technical aspect of how it works, I'd like to have Anthony refer to that.
Mr. Scott, can you?
Yes, members of the committee, this is Anthony Scott of the Division of Oil and Gas. When we first presented to your committee, we showed the importance of certainty for rolled-in rates on the incentives that explorers face. And what we demonstrated or indicated was that having certainty as to rolled-in rates makes a very material difference in the value of a hydrocarbon prospect. The amendment as proposed would create significant uncertainty as to the future rates that an explorer would face. And because of that, it would diminish the attractiveness of the exploration prospect. We believe that opening the basin in a truly competitive way is importantly in the state's interest, and that uncertainty as to rate treatment that the amendment would create would be negative in that regard. I would also like to point out that there are elements of fiscal certainty for different parties in the bill. The initial shippers receive fiscal certainty with regard to tax and royalty that subsequent expansion shippers do not. The bill also provides an element of fiscal certainty for our pipeline licensee so that we don't take them to the dance and then leave them there in terms of the three times damages. We believe creating certainty around the economics of exploration is very important to ensuring that the maximum competitive process for exploration occurs on the North Slope. And that concludes my testimony.
Mr. Bullock.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to have a few comments about regarding the policy issues that you're looking at here. The general policy of the economics of the Gasoline Inducement Act are to maximize the revenue to the state through a low wellhead value. And therefore, a rolled-in rate effectively keeps the rates relatively lower for everybody, but it does run the risk of having the original shippers subject to an increased rate. And so your policy decision is, if first of all, it's the rolled-in versus incremental. Under the incremental, people that take advantage of the new capacity would divide the cost basically among themselves under the increased tariff. And so if you do have the policy of rolled-in rates, why are you doing it, and what's the best way to reach that objective and keep it within the limitations of the tariff that you ultimately want?
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, this is sort of a balancing act, isn't it? If our concern is that the current producers might not come to the open season, then we'd want to vote with Representative Samuels, I think, because this gives them more flexibility in terms of their exposure to higher rates for shipping their gas after they've made the commitment. If our concern is that people won't go out and explore, then we want to vote against the amendment because this gives them, at least in theory, and I'll get to that in a moment, it gives them at least in theory the certainty that if there's actually a pipeline built under the terms of this, then they'd be able to ship new gas at a rolled-in rate. They wouldn't have to pay expanded, whatever the right term there is, rate costs. It's only only in theory, because we don't know who's going to get the first gas into the pipeline when they can still compress it and are still subject to rolled-in rates. It could just as easily be the initial producers who got more gas to the pipeline in some fashion. So if it's a balancing act, I'd like to know a little bit more about how come you came down on the side of the explorers when the whole problem with getting a gas pipeline built is getting the producers to commit gas.
Representative Dugan, to the chair. It is a balancing act, and it is an exercise in judgment in terms of how you believe that people are going to react to different aspects of what we're offering and what we're demanding. And what we are trying to balance in this regard is the relative interest of the explorers in their what their concern would be if they saw the risk of a initial shipper challenge to the rolled-in rates that our geolicense project would have to go forward with, and how much that may impact our long-term interest in seeing exploration take place. That being balanced with how much of a hurdle is this going to represent to the initial shippers in their decision whether to accept our inducements and commit their gas to that initial line. And again, it's an exercise in judgment. We believe fundamentally that the economics of the project are such that once we get that pinned down and demonstrated, that it will provide a significant amount of inducement itself to participate in an open season. We're adding more to be responsive to certain structural issues with regard to our royalty and certain stated concerns about the risk of changes in our production tax, and we're embedding those in there. We believe that all those taken together are going to be a significant driver to get people to commit gas at that initial open season. The question becomes, how much of a hurdle is this requirement going to match up against that otherwise natural flow to get that gas into the line? And again, in our judgment, it's not going to be so significant as to drive people away from that initial open season. And for that reason, we believe that in the balance of the state's interests in this regard, that the potential detriment to the open season is overmatched by the value of getting this certainty for the explorers. And that's what it came down to.
I wanted to note that session starts in 11 minutes, so we'll probably break in about 6 here, and it's obvious we're not going to get through the rest of the amendments before that break, so I will figure out whether we recess till this afternoon or tomorrow. I'll come up with an answer here, hopefully in the next 5 minutes. We'll go to Representative Samuels, followed by Ramos.
Thank you. There's a couple of comments that have been made so far. I would not characterize this as wholeheartedly an explorer versus current producer question. Shells offshore, do they come in first? Do they come in second? Has there compression left? Is there looping left? Anadarko gets under compression, their tariff goes down. The next time when they loop, they're going to argue against. Anadarko, the explorer, is then going to go in, they're going to go, no, I don't think so. Is it NPRA? What's the royalty? What's the tax? All of these things are all this little muddied water over here. You don't know. At the beginning, yeah, I think you can characterize that. But as you look out over time, the point here is the midstream entity must back up what we say in the bill. And FERC has the presumption over that way. So we say, generally speaking, we like the rolled-in tariffs. But these entities, as they change their own economics, depending on where they're exploring, what they find, how big it is, do you really want to force Shell to always say the same thing? One day it might be this, one day it might be that. Exxon might be all over the map. Depends. Are they going to explore? Maybe, maybe not. ConocoPhillips, a great example. They're the largest explorer we have. Sometimes they will want to go for rolled in, sometimes they won't. The state should be, no, I won't even say the state should be consistent. The state may change their opinion 3 governors from now. The FERC will decide this, and I think they should have as much information as possible. Generally speaking, we got the presumption of rolled-in tariffs, and as long as that presumption stays there, the midstream entity has to argue that way. They presume that already, and let everybody else go before FERC and provide them the information. Let them fight it out. As long as that presumption is there, we don't know what the state's position will be. The state. So I'm just saying, this is not a clear cut. I disagree with the characterization that Representative Dugan made, and the commissioner to a certain extent made, that in the short run this would be a producer-explorer thing. But in the long run, the water will get really muddy on who wants what, and just say let all of these entities argue their own interests. Anadarko will be all over the map. Exxon will be all over the map. Chevron was all over the map in the committee. Half the company liked it, and half the company didn't like it. So that's all I'm saying, is provide more information to the body that actually is going to make the decision, rather than them having making decisions in the blind because of a decision we make now.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond to that. I think we all agree that we can't predict what a particular entity's motivation is going to be at the time that an expansion is proposed, whether they're going to be positioned such that they're going to favor rolled in or not. What we do know is that for the most part, except for one particular potential scenario, it's going to be in the state's interest to see rolled in rates. And so what we're saying here is that we want to have we want to bind anybody that's getting our inducement to make sure that their message is consistent, recognizing that one of the reasons why that's valuable to us is because they may have different motivations at the time that the proposal comes in. But we know that consistently ours is likely to be in favor of rolled-in rate treatment. And if we do end up in a scenario where we have a particular outcome that we have offshore, as Representative Samuels has identified, if we have an offshore expansion late in the game when we're talking about looping, and in the grand scheme of things, we decide that from a policy matter, it would be better to go the, another direction, we would be free to speak our minds from the state's perspective. Nothing in the bill precludes that. And similarly, we would be free to release our obligation on the part of other parties at that particular time. But what we do know is that more likely than not, and almost in most instances, it's going to be in the state's interest to see rolled-in rates. And that's why we want to tie that requirement to the value that we're putting into. If we're going to put value into the upstream, we want to tie something to that.
We're going to go to Representative Ramos first, and then to you, Mr. Bullock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I very much understand the commissioner's point of view and the position of the state, but I also understand the position of Representative Samuels. So in this case, although I'm very empathetic to the state's point of view on its handling of roll-in rates, my feeling is that there are too many variables at stake that are unknown, and this is a place where I think we need some to see some elasticity. And it's a valuable place for the FERC to comment, even if it has the negative effect of slowing some of the secondary explorers. I understand perfectly Representative Samuel's point of view that one group that argues 1 year because it's favorable to them argues one way, and the next year they find themselves in an entirely different position. And this makeup of so many different entities ultimately that we want to nominate gas into the pipe are uneven in their makeup. NPRA versus offshore versus the three producers versus some of the secondary people. So as empathetic as I am to the commissioner's argument, and I believe that I understand that, I find myself appreciating the elasticity that Representative Samuels is advocating for. Even though it slows the process, it brings FERC back in incrementally, it affects negatively the ensuing expansions, but I like what it does to the overall architecture, because I'm one of my great concerns is the rigidity of AGEA itself and its inability to attract the broadest amount of licensees initially. And so I find myself defaulting back to that. And so when I weigh the 2 points on number 19, see the administration's point of view, see Representative Samuels' point of view, and I think that the amendment offers elasticity through the licensee phase, so I'm gonna be voting yes for the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Bullock.
Just a short comment. It's Don Bullock again. Really, what you're talking about here is just who's going to be making arguments and what they can argue before FERC. FERC's the one that's going to make the decision, and it'll not only be the people in there that are arguing to keep the tariffs down that were the original shippers that don't want the rolled-in rates, that want the people to share.
Maybe.
But the state will be there, the pipeline owner will be there, the explorers will be there, and FERC will take all those into consideration. So this section just talks about what their limitations might be or might not be in that argument.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly wasn't trying to mischaracterize Representative Samuel's argument here, particularly since he knows so much more than I do and would make a monkey out of me if I tried. But the point I was trying to make is this. If there's actually an incentive that resides in one way or the other that resides in this language, and our primary concern is to get gas at the open season and our secondary concern is to encourage exploration, then it seems to me that I'm going to vote in favor of the amendment, because if there is an incentive that resides there, it resides in the right place.
Thank you. Okay, I'd like to withdraw my objection to the amendment that was for the purpose of discussion as of about a half an hour ago. And you're going to object to the amendment? Okay. Is there any further discussion on amendment number 19? Since there is no further, Madam Clerk, will you please call the roll?
Yes.
Representative Rammer.
Yes.
Representative Dugan.
Yes.
Representative Kawasaki.
No.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom.
No.
Yes. So amendment number 19 has passed.
5-2.
I didn't hear what she said. Did she misquote the number then, or So it was a five yes, a two no? Okay, so with that, amendment number 19 is passed. What I'd like to do is to stop the meeting at this time, since we are just 2 minutes before the start of the floor session. I'm sorry that we weren't able to get through the rest of these amendments today. I had polled members here as to your availability this afternoon. I want to thank everybody for the flexibility. However, I think it would be better if we were to finish this thing tomorrow as opposed to this afternoon, given the fact that there are some potential additional amendments that I've been apprised of, as well as some modifications to those that have been proposed that we haven't gotten to yet. And I think it would be in our best interest just to adjourn this meeting for today, and then we'll reconvene tomorrow at 3 p.m. in the House Resources Room and finish up the legislation at that time.
What time tomorrow?
3 p.m. in House Resources tomorrow. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.